Hello and welcome to the New Rainbow Cast podcast with your host, Autistically R. In this episode, I'll be chatting to Bex Folsom with neurodivergent queer person and member of the Liberal Democrats. We'll be talking about their involvement with the Liberal Democrats as an election year, and to be doing some interviews with people who are politically active within, British politics, and, have some interest in politics, just to get the vibe of what, in terms of policy and ideas, what could things be like for, disabled people in Britain in terms of where they're looking at, like, policy, any of the areas of politics, and looking at as well what life is like. I want to be able to hear from a diverse range of voices, and as I said, Bex is one of them. But if you want to get on a podcast and chat, if you are neurodivergent yourself and or disabled and involved in a political party or any being involved in politics, policy making, or any like charity and organisation that helps disabled people, that has some form of impact and not knowing what it is like to be disabled and what things that need to be done and to improve things for disabled people, as I like to do things in a positive note, positive manner, and so, and look at what we can do for improving things for neurodivergent and disabled people, because I see this podcast as space to be active in that change and actually working towards a positive change and change making, and starting that by conversations. And I, as I said, I want to get diverse things up voices. Like, as myself, I want to keep this podcast quite balanced, but I understand that two guests have been on who have been members of the Liberal Democrats, and I myself are registered as a member, but I want to not make it associated with any political party or any political leaning. So please do, if you are from a different political party, please, or if you know somebody who would be great to come on, please do email newrainbow@newrainbowproject.com. So, and that's rainbow, so rainbow newrainbowproject.com. If you want to get on the podcast, got any questions that I would like me to answer, any themes and ideas for the podcasts, and also if you're from outside of the UK and want to speak on a different issue or like anything relating to politics in your country, please do email, and also DMs open on Instagram and the New Rainbow Project Facebook page. You can send a Facebook message through there, and for TikTok as well. So as I said, we're talking to Bex Folsom about the neurodivergency, so that's autism, ADHD and dyspraxia that they self-diagnosed with, and we'll be also talking about the experiences asexual, aromantic, and the experience as a diverse from a minority gender as a trans non-binary person. We explore what that means for their identity. So, I say please subscribe to this podcast, give it a good review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe on YouTube as well, and please also feel free to share the YouTube videos, and also, you can get clips of the podcast on Instagram and Facebook and TikTok, which will be putting clips on this interview, as with every interviews, and I've got more ideas from episodes to come. So as I said, you know, if you want to ask anything, just email or again in touch with about anything, any comments about this, I would love to hear from you. That said, let's get into this interview.
I'm Bex, and I go by they, she pronouns, and I'm currently studying history and politics at Lancaster University. And I've got various neurodivergent conditions. I'm autistic and ADHD. I've also got prosopagnosia, which is generally understood to be face blindness, or inability to recognise faces. I've also self-diagnosed myself as dyspraxic, and I have a few special interests. My main is in sailing. I also love talking about neurodivergence, identity, queer identity, supporting others with their identity. And it's also my degree. My history and politics are special interests for me.
When you mentioned the face blindness condition, I was reading up about you, so that's like the first time we heard of that word. I heard of ever people with ADHD having that experience of facial blindness. Tell me about how you discovered your divergent condition, how you got diagnosed with them, and how they affect you.
I was diagnosed as autistic at the age of 4. I'm very lucky that I was assigned male at birth, which when getting an autism diagnosis is very helpful. My traits were very stereotypical, with like the way I had meltdowns. I didn't actually talk until I was about 2, and the way I ate and all that stuff. So my parents and also just medical professionals around understood very early on. I would say that even though I had a diagnosis, that did not make school more inclusive or accessible for me. I had a lot of issues at primary school, but it did mean I've always had some understanding of myself from a young age, since my parents told me around the age of 6. Now, my ADHD, I was diagnosed around about 8 or 9. I was very impulsive again from a young age, and yeah, in a very autism ADHD way. And I can very clearly now see that I've got that. But this is also really a box-ticking exercise, because my CAMS psychiatrist knew that I really need to go on ADHD medication. So I needed a diagnosis for that. Now, then I'll mention prosopagnosia. Me and my family have always known that I couldn't recognise faces. At nursery, example, I would call every teacher by the same name, or even some of the kids. And I don't even forget names. I actually remember names really well, but I can walk past someone in the street who I know and I won't even clock that I know them. I have learned strategies of recognising faces, recognise people, which is voices, hairstyles, the height, the way people walk. Again, this was when I got diagnosed, it was a bit of a boxing exercise, just so it ended up being on medical records when I turned 18. My dyspraxia, I self-diagnosed that, or more like with the help of my parents, because they realised that as well. So I've toyed the idea of getting official diagnosis, but it's not really worth it. My fine motor skills have never been amazing. I've struggled writing, building Lego. I love building Lego as a kid. And I couldn't put the stickers on, I couldn't put the fiddly pieces together. And it's actually quite an impairing condition. When I'm sailing, my balance is off completely off. I'll capsize really easily, or I'll struggle maintaining boats.
With face blindness, like, how does it look like for your eyes, being unable to match people's faces up?
People think it might be me drawing a blank when I see them, or people might think that it's me not even being able to see faces. I can see faces fine. It's more like I actually, the kind of neurons in the brain don't connect the fact that is a face to that is a face I know. So again, like someone go, "Hi, Bex," and I will think, "Who on earth are you?" And if I spoke to someone enough, or if they got like a distinct accent or whatever, I can recognise that voice. The fun one is, because I spend a lot of time around other disabled people, including physically disabled people, I'm good at recognising mobility aids. And like hairstyle's a good one, but obviously people can change their hairstyle. Sometimes the way people wear clothes, not necessarily the clothes themselves, but like kind of the style that someone presents themselves as. And context is the other thing. If I was, let's say I arranged to meet up with someone on campus at a particular cafe for a drink or whatever, at a particular time, that in itself is probably the biggest part, is the context. So I will recognise them. It's not that I recognise their faces. I know they'll be there in that time, and then hair and voice and whatever does the rest.
You said before that we've been autistic. I assume we have an ADHD as well, but can have that effect of social anxiety where you can sometimes feel uncomfortable in certain situations where you are being independent, meeting up with certain people, or maybe not only known for a few months or we haven't known for as long. It must be like that must add to your special anxiety about social situations.
I want to talk about masking here. I think the thing that people forget is that masking is actually exhausting, and socializing in general is. So let's say I'm meeting up with a close friend, especially one's neurodivergent, and I can spend like multiple days with them, can stay over with them, and I'll mask minimally, and I'll be around them for ages because I know they'll be fine with me not making eye contact and fine with me just being completely open. But let's say I have three seminars in one day, and that obviously involves a lot of talking to people that I don't really talk outside of that. I will be masking a lot. And people think I'm not. People think you're really open, especially if it's a module that's talking about disability or talking about something I'm close to, and I won't mask much. But no, I am masking a lot. And then at the end of that day, I have to shut myself away in my room for hours. So building confidence is actually a really slow process. And you have to accept that you can't live up to people's expectations of acting like a neurotypical. You learn the people you can mask around, or you don't need to mask around, and the way you regain spoons, which is, if anyone doesn't know, that's your social energy. And I've learned who I feel safe around and who I have to like put a smile on the face and go, just sort of pretend that everything's a little bit, pretend I'm being normal, but I'm actually not. This is something I'm working on. And I've made mistakes even since I've been home for Easter, where I'll just go, oh, I can do this, I can do that. And then by the end of the evening, I'm like wanting to just lie down and not being able to do anything.
I think it's like that thing, and she was diagnosed at the age of 4, I think you just said, you know, that primarily for an autistic person, and as you said, he was assigned male at birth and had that kind of typical male presentation, which I can assume that for those reasons, people might not think you mask as much. Stigma stereotype can be quite a barrier to being fully understanding the subtleties of masking. And do you want to explain what it was like getting that diagnosis at a young age? Are you able to be open about yourself with your autism and ADHD from a young age? Were you able to talk about that with any friends and peers in your school groups?
The helpful thing for me is that it was drilled into me quite young. My parents only told me about the fact I had the diagnosis when I was about six, because that's the age I could understand it at. But they've always talked about it really openly with me, helped me see that it's not necessarily negative. I think for a very long time I did see it as really negative, really impairing, and but I've learned to love it. I was at a special school for a while. I know a lot of people have opinions on special schools. A lot of people don't like them, but there we were taught to talk openly and be articulate about a lot of issues like with our diagnoses. Think of me as more autistic than that someone else because I look like I mask less. But the thing I find that's interesting is the way you're often treated with that sort. You're often patronized. You often talked down to. You're often gone, oh yeah, wow, you went on a train journey by yourself. That is now amazing. And I'm like, look, I'm doing a degree, so I can do that. I'm traveling all around the country to do sailing events, or I'm like really independent and I look after myself, all that stuff. And like that for me is just normal. People will often talk down to me and go, oh, it isn't life so hard for you, oh, all I'll be patronizing just because of that appearing to mask less. And but then at the other end of it, I'd say that a lot of people who don't mask as much will often be told, oh, you don't look autistic, because as if there's a way to be autistic. So the less masking way is a blessing and a curse. I see it in a way as the blessing of it can encourage other people to be more open, and it helps people become more aware. But at the same time, it turns heads that sometimes you don't want.
For a period of time, we went to specialist school? What was that like for yourself? What was that experience of school like for yourself?
For me, it starts back right to primary school. I went to the school that was at the end of my road, so just a 5-minute walk, and it'd been where my older sister had gone. Unfortunately, it's a really difficult experience for me. I only stayed in that school until the start of year four, mostly because of real misconduct from teachers and TAs, teaching assistants, who were just treating me as if I had bad behaviour and did a lot of things that were incredibly horrible to me, shutting me in a room after having a meltdown and holding that door shut and in a blank room. Really, really traumatic experiences. So I probably have some form of PTSD from that. But I then moved from there to a village school in the next village over. I live in a town that's a village over, so not many people came from my town to go there, which was more supportive. It was more community orientated. But it didn't really have the resources to support me because my autism traits at that point were a lot of meltdowns, emotional outbursts, and becoming overwhelmed really easily. So then, by the start of year six, my parents moved me to a special school that had a primary school unit that I was moved into, and then moved from there into the main part of the school. My experiences of that is that the support you get from school staff is amazing. They're all obviously trained more specially in that, and it's a small environment. Your classes only have about 8 or 10 people at the most, so I was a lot more supported and taught to be a lot more reflective. I had went from a very self-selecting diet to eating a lot more food because staff always ate with us and encouraged me to try things. I struggled more with friendships because you'd think that a load of autistic people together would at a school, or people with similar neurodivergent needs would love getting on with each other, but no, in reality we all clashed. So I struggled and I was bullied at points. I had really difficult moments, but I came out the end of it and I was much more comfortable. I got my GCSEs there, and then I went on to a mainstream sixth form, and I wouldn't be able to go to that mainstream sixth form without having that more dedicated support around me beforehand. And it was interesting going back into that mainstream setting because I was at sixth form, but in a secondary school separated from everyone else, just me and a year 12, year 13 people. I was comfortable back there, but a lot of the teachers didn't really understand autism or neurodivergent conditions. I had to do a lot of explaining. I could see how overwhelming the environment was. I could only be there because I'd had that support in place beforehand. And why, if I wouldn't have had that support in place, I wouldn't have been able to be there.
When you were mentioning about before, you were saying that people think you're maskless than other autistic people who were diagnosed later on in life. The more assigned female at birth presentation of autism. Do you want to go into how people think maskless? What is your presentation of autism now?
On the surface level, people know that I just talk about it a lot. So at university, if I'm doing any particular module in my degree that is related in any way to anything that I could end up bringing autism up in, I'll generally end up bringing it up in a seminar at least some point, or I'll just randomly mention it at points. Vast majority of my friends, in fact, probably almost all of them, know about autism. Even people that I'm not close to, I just know about it because I'm open about it. But then there's also element where I struggle even making an effort to make eye contact. I know that the strategy is generally you look to someone's forehead, and I try to do that when I really have to, but I struggle with that sort of stuff. I have a tendency to, for example, to overshare in conversations and just talk really openly, and sometimes even make people a little bit uncomfortable if I do that wrong. So there's a lot of things that I do with that sort of stuff. I really struggle bottling stuff up. I think that's how it works, and it's also been a thing of I didn't know how to mask, because again, a thing where it's socialization, as we're talking about with the way people assign male or assign female. With me, obviously, guys are not taught to socially mask in the way that girls are. So the autistic girls, or the particularly autistic cis girls that I know, will have less likely would have been masking because the social role they're taught to be in is one that is more naturally masking, even for neurotypicals. The people that are assigned female at birth, I know autistic, tend to be diagnosed teen to 20s. And I do know some people assigned male with assigned about that age as well, but I know a lot more who were assigned, who are diagnosed as children. It also means that there is definitely a tendency for to be that difference in masking in that sense.
And it seems to be really big, this difference in masking, and has been able to talk about your experience of being autistic. But as you said, that you were diagnosed at the age of 4 and knew about it from the age of 6, and had that environment from going to a specialist education. And I guess because it was a very intolerant sort of certain sensory things, being able to communicate a lot more about your autistic experience. Sometimes you can see it as a privilege of being able to know how to talk more about your experience of being autistic and be able to talk to yourself and be open about it. But as you said, if you come from that background where you struggled in the mainstream to extent, you had to change schools and being quite intolerant to certain sensory senses, there's a lot of nuances to it. You self-diagnosed with dyspraxia. That does very affect you when it comes to doing stuff like sailing and fine motor skills. But how did you find out about that and clicked on to thinking you're dyspraxic, and how has it affected you through your life? And do you think that you were able to have support for any undiagnosed traits of dyspraxia?
Yeah, so it's a thing that definitely me, my parents, family, teachers, people around me just realized it over time that, yeah, I struggled with my handwriting from a young age. I could write stories and I could do actual writing really well, but I couldn't handwrite for the life of me. And what as we taught, I would struggle again. When I said doing, I spent so much of my early adolescence doing Lego, but as soon as it was a difficult piece that I needed to put together or I had to put a sticker on or something like that, I'd have to go and get my mum or my dad to do that for me. So we just realised it slowly. I've been tempted occasionally to try and go for a screening or official diagnosis just to complete the set of things I've got, but it's not really worth it. And then in terms of like how it the support I get, it's hard to get, especially at university, it's really hard to get support about diagnosis for pretty much anything. And there's not loads that we can do apart from teaching myself to be more confident in my fine motor skills. At university, the thing that is helpful is I'm entirely laptop based. And I'm not just entirely laptop based in the sense that's what I use in lectures and that's what I write my essays on. It's also in exams. And that's the thing that I started at sixth form. It was agreed that I could be laptop based at both in lessons and in exams. I noticed at the very least, my parents and my teachers noticed as well that fluency in my writing went up hugely because we'd always known that there was a writing ability that I had, even though I was very much stereotypically pushed into the autistic kid must like maths direction. I was more of a writer, and that fluency went up. And I could be honest, in my degree, I haven't even touched my pen case. I carry a pen in my bag so that I can sign a form if I need to, but that's it. Let's say in sailing, example, that's my big special interest, and it's a huge so. In sailing, your boat is like an extension of your body. You need to be keeping it in raised condition. You need to set it upright. And I might sit on the front trying to do a split pin for 5, 10 minutes solid because I can't. And I'm also working on my balance and the amount of times that I will dunk myself in the water because I'm leaning out too much or I'm not leaning out enough and I end up falling in. When I've done stuff in boats and other people, I have to stand up to do something. Usually it's one person standing on either side of me ready to catch me. Yeah. Even on land, like I'm unsteady on my feet. I will be walking around my uni flat and I will only be able to move places by like holding on to something. Don't have that good balance, and that's part of it. Again, it's fine motor skills, and I try to work on those fine motor skills as much as I can, but it is difficult. It's actually much more of an impairing, like specific learning disability than people think of. People think, oh, yeah, it's just the brother of dyslexia. But in reality, a very difficult condition to live with. I haven't even tried learning to drive yet, and it took me until about 14 to learn to do my shoelaces. The other thing I was going to mention with that, I tie knots a lot for sailing. That's become a thing I'm actually quite good at because I just do that as a stim.
Sometimes I guess that If you can have that as a system B, I guess it can help you develop the quality of do nothing. But as you said, it's something that I haven't learned to drive myself. Shoelaces isn't something that I'm still yet to master, but it's something, yeah, you might, if you can have that talent as we're doing sort of things like driving and whatever, especially if you've got autism and ADHD as well, because with the senses and all that as well, with the driving. It can be, doesn't make it harder, but if you got the support in place of being able to use a computer in university and got those sort of adjustments and seeing if people are accommodating to your needs in sailing, I suppose then you don't need a diagnosis if you can be able to manage yourself without getting a diagnosis and being and having that resilience, which I think if you're undiagnosed, can build up resilience over the years without a diagnosis.
Again, it's something diagnosis is something I've thought about before, and I've thought at this point, because pretty much every other diagnosis had a reason, and this one I could get by without. There's nothing, you can't medicate for dyspraxia. You people say, yeah, it's just helpful to have it on the list, but in reality, I just need to tell people I'm around about it. And I do have that support. Fortunately, that like in sailing, for example, I have other people that help me maintain boats or who help me when I'm rigging them. So there are things that you can do, and fine motor skills are things that can be worked on.
One of the topics listed is like to do with your like involvement in certain communities and political activism. It's like I know you're a member of the Liberal Democrats, which I am myself, member of it myself, which the party is about the liberal ideology and progressive liberalism in the UK. Do you want to tell me about how you, why you joined the party and why you got involved in politics?
It's weird because I joined because of Brexit, and that goes back to, for me, to 2019. My dad had also joined because of Brexit after a very long time of being politically inactive, and he was then standing to be local councillor in my ward where I live, and I just found myself volunteering delivering leaflets for him and putting up posters and doing what I can to help him get elected because I agree with him and I cared about him. And then I just found that I agreed with what the party was saying, especially on Brexit. I was very strongly opinionated about, I did not want us to leave the European Union. I saw a lot of benefit for young people. I saw a lot of economic benefit in remaining in the EU, and I wanted to fight for that second referendum and to stop it. So we were coming up to the 2019 general election, and I was still going out and delivering those leaflets, and I thought, I'm going to join a member in my own right. So I did, and unfortunately at the end of that there was quite a big defeat in the 2019 election, not just for Lib Dems, but generally for the whole progressive side of politics. But I stayed. I stayed because I care about those liberal values. I became more of a liberal as the more time spent there, because I was like, I care about liberties and I care about the rights of minority groups. I felt economically I trusted the party with kind of the way that we are supportive of social welfare, but also have economic policies that will actually be implemented. I just felt at home, and I've not really looked back since.
Where did that interest come from? Have you always been interested in politics?
To an extent, yeah. I had some interest for a long time. I was paid attention to the news even as a child. I'd always like be having the news on, and I cared more about it as I became a teenager. Obviously, when we're talking around 2010 election, I was probably about six at times, didn't really know what was happening, didn't really just about understood what was happening around about the time we got to the 2015 election and the referendum. I pretty much did understand what was happening, but I followed it. My political opinions bounced around like a sort of ping pong ball, but I think for a lot of teenagers, that's what happens. And at what certain points, I would have probably been quite socially conserved, and not like big socially conservative. I wasn't like a nationalist or anything, but I don't understand closeted asexual moment. I was like, I don't understand all these things about sexuality. Why don't we just not have them? I'd be probably like polyphobic or something, because I just didn't understand why someone would want one partner, then why would they want many? So I bounced around for, and at one point I bounced around quite left wing as well, and I was anti-capitalist because it was cool. But that happens for a lot of people, and I'd say that if you've seen that happen, then don't be ashamed of your old views, laugh at them and go, actually, at least you were interested. At least you were interested enough. Then by the time that I was getting like 14, 15, 16, I was having views that I did stand behind and that I was very happy to support. The one thing kept in line once I'd shaken off all that weird, I don't like things that I think things I don't like should be banned, political teenage moment, I ended up becoming very socially progressive, and that's the one thing that stayed ever since.
Up to talking about the 2019 election, I think you was in like probably at sixth form age, roughly between 16 and 18.
I was actually at 15 at the time, so I was in my year 11 at my special school. And by that point, yeah, I didn't have many people, many friends. I just spent a lot of time to myself. But one of the teachers noticed that I was very into politics. And so on, I think a few couple of months before, it was UK Parliament week, and we ran a referendum. And I was the one who ran it. I came up with the question, which is about whether the school should stop using single-use plastics or single-use plastic cups. I ran a very corrupt referendum. I came up with the question, ran the yes campaign, and was also the returning officer. Then we ran a general election as well on the day of the general election. And again, for that one, part of the thing I did the previous week, I went online, found all the manifestos for all the parties, effectively condensed the manifestos into five main points for each party, and put them up on a poster so that people could decide which party they wanted to vote for. And then again, I ran that election, created a ballot paper, ran the was the returning officer, did the counting, everything.
He was more interested than most people by age, and I suppose at the age of 15 and 16, that's when things are starting to solidify. Again. How did that feel then, the way that you started more socially conservative? Has that evolved as your own personal identity has evolved?
Yeah, the thing of your adolescence is that it's the time your brain's growing, your brain's trying to make sense of the world. And when you get to being a teenager, you actually do think for yourself a lot, and you're trying to make sense of stuff. And I was there, and all around me that I struggle a lot of things, and most of like those ideas I know I've gone back on, but in a way I'm happy I had ideas. And I was never like, I was never homophobic. I think I would have gone, I don't understand people being gay, but I didn't really understand what being gay meant. I might have been at the time anti-abortion, but that was because I didn't actually understand the issue, and I didn't like the idea of any life being lost. But now I looked at it a couple of years later, and I was like, oh, actually, that makes me exceptionally pro-choice, because that is really the one that is safest. And so your ideas bounce around a lot, and that's just a thing that happens. I played for a few years. I was very active on the web app nation states, where you create a country and rule it through a lot of very satirical issues. And it's interesting that when I started, I was always ended up tending to be in the weirdly left wing authoritarian country, because it was a bit weird. And I was like, I don't understand this, because I don't feel like I'm that. But I knew inside it's not I'm like. I did all that bouncing around. I think everyone does in some way. I think you just have to accept your ideas change. And in a way, like I was fairly liberal when by the time I joined the Lib Dems, but I became much more liberal by being a member and being accustomed to it. I hated anything that was police state. I hated any anti-civil liberties legislation, anti-freedom of protest legislation. That's very much the seeds of being very socially progressive, socially liberal.
Joining the party has allowed you to join a wider social community within the members of the party by regularly attending the conferences and being on members of the board. What has it been like finding fellow peers within the Young Liberals community, and how has that expanded your social community? Has that helped build confidence for yourself?
It's really challenging just being a young person in politics. Most parties are really older dominated. They're because old people have more time on their hands, more money on their hands. So it doesn't really matter which party you're in, generally. It's probably the only exception, I presume, would be the Greens. Other than that, most of the time, or you are basing yourself around a lot of older people. I'm semi-active as a campaigner. I try to go out and deliver leaflets as much as I can, but often not able to. And you spend a lot of time just around older people, or you often feel like you're bringing that average age of those meetings down. But I've actually been quite comfortable. I'm really open about my neurodivergency. Everyone pretty accepting of that. I believe some people who have occasionally have been a little bit patronizing, as you get anywhere. Recently, I've been open to talk about gender and sexuality as well. The funny thing is, in young liberals in the youth wing, I came out via running an election, came out via election manifesto. Everyone knew me by my previous name. I'm running for these positions again, and I've got a new name. But YL, that youth wing, really accepting community. It can be a bit intense sometimes going to those conferences because it's can be masculine dominated, but it is an environment where you can be yourself, you can explore yourself, you can make friends. I at sixth form, I had very few friends. I had about one friend that I kept until after sixth form, and I had people I'd spend time around. So instead, I'd spent a lot of time when I was at home or even at school, just chatting, texting my friends that I've made in the Dems, in Young Liberals, and keeping up to date with them. And I still do. And even now, I'm not always talking with friends nationally in Young Liberals all the time, but I've a great catch up with them every 6 months or so when I go to a conference. I've got people I know through my uni society who are really nice as well and made brilliant friends there. So it's a really good social community. It's one that there's a lot of neurodivergent people in, which helps. And you know that everyone will generally be accepting and are willing to understand. And that's helpful as well.
Yeah, I can imagine how that's quite helpful. And I know that within the Liberal Democrats, the Youth Party, I've seen there's quite many members who are autistic themselves. And that can be same for the parties who were deemed as progressive or centre to left leaning, like parties like Green Party to Labour Party. And so why do you think that is, and how is it also having other members in the community who are also autistic and neurodivergent?
Yeah, the way I've seen it is that autistic people in particular have a very strong sense of justice, and that often translates into seeking to achieve some form of social justice. So I presume for a lot of autistic people in, let's say, Labour, that's often around class and class inequality and wealth inequality. Or in the Greens, that's probably often a lot about climate justice and caring for the planet. And I know through people, not necessarily Green Party members, but who've been very strong climate activists will often be campaigning because they've got this sort of sense of justice for the world. And I have that sense, but in a way that's more manifested from my other areas of politics. And for me, like my sense of social justice, I think originally was a little bit economic in that the sense of the Lib Dem welfare policies. But it for now, a lot of it is about rights for groups and even ones that I'm not in. So that's women's rights and rights of ethnic minorities and immigration rights. Immigration's a huge issue that I care about a lot. But then it's also my groups, queer people and disabled people. And that's for me, that sense of justice is what creates it in a way. And I presume for, let's say, nationalist parties like the SNP, I wouldn't know personally, but I presume it might be a sense of almost historical justice because often the way that people in more independence leaning parties see it is they see that there's a need historically to separate from a country. I, as a historian, wouldn't really think that argument holds much water, but if they do, then that's in a way a sense of justice. And that's the way, and it's often about the stereotype of autistic people going, that's not fair. And I'm like, yeah, we do, because often it isn't. I think we're always crying about fair things not being fair because we don't like them. But in a way, a lot of us just can't get over something not feeling right.
Was that been meeting and engaging with other neurodivergent autistic people within the party? And have you been able to meet a lot more friends who are neurodivergent and autistic? Has that given you that benefit of having more friendships?
Yeah, so when I was at my special school, I knew, again, virtually everyone had was either autistic or ADHD or had some form of what we term social emotional mental health needs. And I didn't really make many friends there because I just struggled with that. But I learned through politics that I could actually have really good friendships with other neurodivergent people. And by this point, like most of my friends are neurodivergent, and I've become incredibly close to a lot of people. And you go and understand these shared experiences, and you don't have to explain things as much. There's a lot of camaraderie. I've seen it as really positive. I'm actually the disabled representative for Young Liberals, and I know a lot of people really enjoy working with me on that. And I can to make it an inclusive space, but it's I've really enjoyed being able to like make those connections with other neurodivergent people and spend more time around them. So for me, that's been really positive.
Before I touch upon your role within the Young Liberals or with your disability rep as a representative there, with studying politics and history in university, what has been like all interacting with other people who have opposed ideal beliefs and people from other parties and maybe like discussing politics and debating with them?
University is a really interesting space. History is often quite chill, quite relaxed, but in politics, on a politics course, you do spend a lot of time around people with very different ideas. And that's both left wing and right wing. I remember at my sixth form in my politics class, I was one of the most right wing people, despite being left of centre myself. But at university, I've met people who are in some form neurodivergent and in conservatives in some ways, and I disagree with them on a lot, and I have to be less open with people. I haven't got on as well with the conservatives in at university because they tend to be a little bit more intense to be doing events with, like cross-party events. They tend to be a little bit more rowdy. I have more accessibility issues with them, and then like it you do spend more time again with people that are left wing as well, and it's nice, and everyone tends to be happy to discuss things, have a bit of fun, let our hair down occasionally. It's so I think university has been hot, positive for me, but it is hard. I'm going to be honest, I don't have many friends in my course through the sailing club or various places that are on the course for me that I'm friends with, but people that I'm on my course with and I am friends with through the course is actually very few, because I'm spending a lot of time discussing like quite big issues with people. Even though we don't often discuss, let's say, this big issue, we'll talk about a whole very contentious thing about a certain government or a certain issue internationally, and that can be really intense.
What is it like being in space sometimes where you feel like you have to be less open to feel a bit more safe and comfortable within yourself?
That again is also quite difficult. We try to do a lot of cross-party society events at uni, and I'm able to do some of them, but not all of them. They tend to be a loud, rowdy in a way sometimes, and I just go, I have to make sure that beforehand I'm rested, and then afterwards I'm like, sorry everyone, I could go to the bar, to the pub with you, go somewhere, but I just gotta go back to my flat and lie down for a bit. So it's difficult, and coping that stuff's difficult in a way. I find I just, instead of trying to close myself off, I spend time around the people I trust, and I am open with them. And I go, if you try to be difficult to me or anything, I'm the disabled representative and the trans representative for the party societies. If there's any issue, I can go to myself. People are quite protective of each other within the society, so it's difficult, and I've learned to deal with it. And even like at a party conference, even at Young Liberals conference, I had to be a little bit masked because they can be quite intense. They can be quite difficult, but I find ways to get through it. I was going to talk about like how inclusive like what Young Liberals conference is, and it's one where we could be much more inclusive. I'm trying as hard as I can as like disabled representative to make sure that we have quiet room, and that we make sure that the venue is accessible, and that we have breaks at the right time, and we have people that you can go to if you feel stressed. It's really difficult because at the end of the day, a lot of people who are neurotypical turn up and they will forget that actually there's other people that find this stuff intense. So for them, they're not actually being uninclusive, they're just forgetting. And you have to be working with the other people that you know care about this stuff to go, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? Have you made sure this is accessible? You made sure that's accessible. And these spaces could be more inclusive. I'm happy that I could be myself, and a lot of people who really can be themselves, but physical events could be a lot more accessible than they are right now. And the same thing again at uni, that I have to work. I work a lot with, for example, the people on the politics society who I don't even regularly attend, but I try and make sure that, look, we're at an event and the Tories are trying to drum on the tables to make a load of noise. That's not accessible for a neurodivergent person, not accessible for anyone who's got hearing aids or any impairments in that way, or anyone's got any sensory processing issues, can you just stop them? But often they don't listen, and that makes it harder.
And I think drumming on the table thing, it's something that I've seen on the TV before as watching certain votes in the room of the House of Parliament doing confidence votes. And you do see Conservative MPs drumming on the table from TV voicing off like Westminster politics. It's been quite a rowdy and loud environment that isn't in its nature that is accessible and inclusive to disabled people with different needs. And so, as I said, there are some things that you would like to be improved within Lib Dems conferences and events in general. But different identities and being neurodivergent and being a part of the LGBT community, how inclusive and safe do you find being in the Liberal Democrats to be?
I think anyone who's like deeply involved within UK politics will know that pretty much every major party's got a transphobia issue at the moment. Obviously, Conservatives, generally speaking, just are transphobic. There are pockets that aren't within it. I've really struggled seeing what Labour's leadership has said because they often will end up being transphobic to gain votes. And the Greens are generally fine, but then they'll have these issues that come every so often. We'll have our issues. And every, generally, the major parties will have some pressure group within them that will be fairly anti-trans. And it's, I'm going to try and explain this simply because it is actually difficult when you don't understand a party structure. But it's really difficult in the Lib Dems to remove someone because of, their views. And it's not in the sense that I know that transphobes or anti-trans people will say that, oh, we're just exercising our free speech, but we aren't a party that is just say whatever you want, because then that would be anything from George Galloway to Nigel Farage, which isn't a party. But what we do is we can remove people when they go against our values. And some of our values are that we oppose discrimination against people on basis of gender, on gender assignment, disability, race, sexual orientation. There's various other values that coincide with that. And also, if someone is just making our members uncomfortable, you can always remove them. But it's difficult. I've never had to make a complaint against someone myself, but I've known people who have, and they're often difficult. It's often difficult to prove. The parties occasionally made things about saying, oh, we're protecting gender critical beliefs, which I'm not particularly on board with. So it's really difficult. But at the same time, for a lot of people I know, a lot of LGBTQ+ people, the Lib Dems is the place they're most comfortable because there's especially young people, it's very actually almost dominated by LGBTQ+ people. And there are a lot of trans people involved in the party as well. I can go to a conference, go out campaigning and just film myself. It's funny though, because I'll go on the doorstep and I'll be knocking on obviously random people like voters' doors, and I'll knock on one who will say that remarkably anti-woke, and I will be scared out of my skin if I'm honest. Because I'm like, hope you don't realise me. But it's difficult. I personally feel comfortable. The anti-trans people say they support free and open debate within the party, and that's now a dog whistle. And we don't feel comfortable. A lot of us don't feel comfortable about how we are targeted online or at events. I say we've got hope though, and that's the thing that. The main thing we need in politics is hope. Our parliamentary party is so supportive. Not necessarily the Lords as much, they're generally supportive, but all of our MPs are very much pro-LGBTQ+ rights and pro-trans rights. Even I know that people have said stuff about, let's say, Tim Farron before, but as somebody who actually actively gone up and campaigned for him when I'm up in Lancaster, I know that he's not a homophobe or a transphobe or anything that people say he is. And the party leadership is not going to throw any of these communities under the bus to get votes. That's what other parties might do. They might decide, okay, we're going to a whole anti-trans campaign to try and win these target seats. We won't do that. And that's I'm quite happy about. And in reality, anti-trans activists are very much a minority within the party. We've seen that at federal. I haven't been to a federal conference, but I've heard from people who have been there, and I've seen that when they try to run a vote on something, transphobic, or when they try to do something procedural or try to do a constitutional amendment, it generally fails quite horribly because they are such a small group within the party. And most people I know that are active in the party are very amazingly supportive for trans people. And if people aren't really supportive, they're generally just indifferent. And I'm fine with people just being indifferent. But I understand why we're uncomfortable, and I'm personally uncomfortable in a lot of ways, but it's hard.
It can be a hard thing with big things. There is a minority within the party itself, because it's like when they look like in a party for different positions, that was like a minority, the manifestos that people put in, because you have so many different roles and positions to go for in the main parties, votes for internal roles. You did have transphobic or gender critical with things, but it's something that when it comes to actually having votes on a subject, that have follows people to stand, and they have of most often lost those votes. But it's something I've said that I think trans and non-binary people in politics find is more an issue when you're dealing with people when on doorsteps or in places of public debate, like social media, when you enter in people an environment beyond your own political views. Is that something that you feel? And how do you think for young people, young LGBTQ people, that do you think politics is a safe space to enter in?
In a way that it's safe enough that you can be involved, but you have to, in the more open you are having to put yourself in the firing line. The example I'd use is someone who's relatively young, but not say the sort of young liberal's age. I live in Oxfordshire when I'm at home, and my local MP is Leila Moran. She, a few years back, had to come out as pansexual. And the reason why she did was because what happened is that the right wing tabloids had worked out somehow, and I think they'd apparently been even doing stuff like phoning around her neighbours. They'd been talking to people at Westminster. They were trying to work out whether who she was dating, and the fact that she had a they'd worked out the fact that she had a female partner. So it wasn't really safe for her, and she didn't want to be outed. So she had to come out. She came out publicly. We were all very supportive of her, and but it's a shame that she had to do that. I don't know if she'd have been ready, but she probably was probably not the time she wanted to. And in a similar way, often we'll have to be on the doorstep. I haven't had it before, but people will often be on asked transphobic questions on the doorstep. That gotcha thing. Like, I want to catch this campaigner out rather than wanting to know an honest answer. The thing is with politics is that you have to put yourself in that firing line sometimes just to get your rights. And there's no way that we're going to get a more inclusive society for disabled people without more disabled people being in parliament. And the same thing, we're not going to get a more inclusive society for plus community people without more LGBTQ plus people in parliament. And in terms of like local councils, I'm seeing more and more trans and non-binary people standing for council, getting elected, and that's brilliant. And I'm very happy to see it. But I don't feel like we're in an especially safe position at the moment. I don't feel like we've actually. It's not like you can become involved as a trans person, non-binary person, and go, okay, I'll be fine because the Equality Act protects me. All this stuff protects me. You will probably end up having some flak come against you, either locally, nationally. The thing is, I know as a historian, you look at protest movements and rights, and the only way that they often achieved is by the group themselves fighting for them, whether that be like gay rights and having the Stonewall riots and then more gay people and get elected to parliament here and Congress in America, or whether that be like folks woman and how that was only possible really with a sustained campaign by both the suffragist and the suffragette movements. We have to be involved, but in a way you have to do it and you have to take steps to protect yourself. And you have to be confident and or at least fake confidence. And it's a huge challenge. So I would say that we can try and make it a safe space. We can make safe spaces within politics, and we can make support networks that are absolutely crucial. And there are brilliant organizations. There's like LGBT plus Lib Dems. There's obviously all the LGBT plus organizations. There's groups that often talk with each other about making sure that this is a safe space for trans people. Still, really, politics itself is not a safe space. It's just you can only have that safe spaces within it.
How do you think your politics can be made a safe space for people of minority groups?
To be honest, the only way it's going to happen is when the culture wars end. And I'm worried that's not going to happen for a while, to be honest. It's because ultimately trans people and immigrants, particularly first generation immigrants and ethnic minorities and disabled people, and we're all targets. That's because it's for a lot of parties, for it can be a vote winner to make a big thing over us. I think we need a more accepting environment, more inclusive environment, but that really involves that rhetoric just being toned down. But let's talk about fight for trans rights. And what I'd say to any cis allies, anyone who's not trans, not non-binary, who wants to politics become a more safe space for trans people. And what I'd say is make sure that when you are advocating for trans rights and non-binary rights, that you're very careful about the way you do it. Because if you do it the wrong way and you make it look like a debate, you've opened up a firing line against the trans people you're allied to. If you make it look like it is a issue that can be a debate, a question, if you're looking at it in the same way that you debate housing policy, then you're opening up that attack line. So what you'd want to do is to be effectively going, this is not a debate. This is advocating for someone's rights. And you need to be marching in tune, marching in line with trans people and non-binary people. You have to be careful when you're an ally of other communities to make sure you don't make that problem worse.
To go on to role as a disabled rep, as a representative, do you want to introduce about that role and what that role means and what you do within it?
I'm the disabled representative on our diversity committee, which is a subcommittee in the organisation that focuses on inclusion of diverse voices. There's me, there are two separate representatives, the LGBT community. There's one that's for sexualities, LGBT, like lesbian, gay, bisexual, and asexual. There's one that's specifically on trans. There is an ethnic minority representative. There's a representative promoting social mobility. There's a women's representative. There's a carers representative. Those all those sort of positions, and it's chaired by a officer who is on the Young Liberals executive, who focuses on accessibility, diversity, and standards. And for me, that ro the role is really whatever you can make want, because we do our diversity committee meetings every so often, and we will talk about issues and what our plans are going forward. Part of that role is just promoting stuff. I've done a little bit before of writing long pieces to go out on. I did it last year for Neurodiversity Celebration Week. I'm hoping to do something for Disability Pride Month that will be more about disability pride in general rather than just neurodiversity. My role also unofficially includes making sure that the organisation's accessible. Officially, that is more a role for that officer, but I assist her in making sure that conference has, let's say, a quiet room and that it's physically accessible, that the hearing that there are hearing loops, all that stuff. And I'm also there to people to account, executive officers to account if they do something that's not particularly accessible. So it's mainly a representative role. And that representative can be internal, can be external. So if I wanted to make sure that, I mean, a way, make sure that the organization is accessible, but if there's a huge issue about disability nationally and I thought we need to create a statement on it, I'd be the one writing that statement. It's hard because often there are big bits of news about disability, but they're often not worth writing anything about because they don't really make headlines. They get near to the headlines, and it'd be a bit weird if we made a statement about them.
You know, you have written some of the policy like that to Young Liberals advocate for, which I've written down some of highlights for. And so do you want to go into what you're trying to promote and advocate for when you're writing certain policy or when you're writing statements?
I am the author of the Young Liberals Special Educational Needs Policy. So SEND issues are not particularly focused on within policy. It's a huge crisis, as most people in the sector, in education and in disability advocacy, would say, but it's not often talked about much. And I had a big ambition not long after becoming involved in YL to write a policy on that. So I spent about 6 months working on it. I did it with a friend who's not disabled because I really wanted to make sure that I wasn't going really overboard on ideas that would be unachievable. But I wanted to have my personal experience and to really deliver it from my personal experience. I stand by it. It was amended in the end, and I'm fine with the amendment that happened. It was also passed almost unanimously. I made a big speech when we at the conference when it's proposed, and I was actually voted for best speech for that speech. I got a standing ovation from it, so that was a huge thing. But yeah, that's been a thing. And I was hoping that could eventually become federal policy. We haven't been able to take it to a federal conference yet. So it won't be in this manifesto. It might be in in a future one. But at the very least, it's got people thinking about that issue. It's got people thinking about what we can do to make the school environment more accessible, more inclusive. It's got people thinking. And that for me is the big impact. It's the only policy I've written and passed previously. I've considered writing other policies. I've not really had the time to usually. It's one of my proudest achievements.
After discussing your school experience, it's something that I think that has influenced the policy and your own personal experience because it talks about waiting lists to get more access for women. I want to give a summary of the brief summary of the SEND policy you worked on.
I got to remember because I haven't looked at it in a while. It was we wanted it to be both experience led and a little bit data led as well. So, like a lot of policies, the first section is really noting down the issues and telling everyone why there's an issue and about how the lower rates of attainment, there's higher rates of exclusion. And personally speaking, I actually lost count of the number of times I was excluded in during primary school. And we were focusing on all that. And then it was divided into a few different sections. We did a bit on funding, was one of the main areas of focus, because in reality, that's probably the largest issue is the fact that there are the schools are tremendously underfunded. So even when they're trying to have an accessible environment, they aren't able to. Another one, and I think this for me is the second biggest issue, is teacher training. And the fact is that teachers get very little training on anything disability related, despite the fact that, as we know, disabled people are approximately or 25% of the population. It's probably a little bit lower for people of school age, but it's still a very large percentage of the population, and they have very little training on it. I don't can't remember if I included it in policy, but one of my ideas I had, and this one I stand by, is I personally think that every teacher should have at least one day of placement should when they're doing teacher training should be working with disabled pupils, and that could be in, let's say, a special school. It could be in a what we call a base, which is effectively almost like a special school within a or special school setting within a mainstream school, or it could be shadowing a what we call a SENCO, so a special needs coordinator, or whatever, and that would just give some experience. And there being more training, a lot of them training being led by disability groups, i.e., disabled led disability advocacy groups. So that was a lot of it was focusing on those. I also wanted to include one bit, and I think it ended up being taken out by the amendment. I wanted to include a bit on improving special school provision because, personally, my experience is that special schools are a very good solution. I'm quite controversial in that a lot of people say it's really segregationist. My perfect solution, perfect world, I don't think this will happen for a while, would actually be where we have special schools and mainstream schools on the same site coordinating. Because at the end of the day, there are always going to be new special schools. There's always going to be a need for people to go to that sort of setting. Simply through sheer size of schools, they can be very inaccessible in that sense. In a way, having people being able to fluctuate between a special school and a mainstream school on the same site means you've not really got segregation. You've just got specialist support. I don't think that's realistically going to happen anytime soon. But I would love there to just be more cooperation in that sense. And yeah, more training. The only thing that's really going to help this change happen, I couldn't put this in the policy because it's not really something you can call for. It's not a short-term thing you can call for, but it's really just cultural change and having an educational setting that's more, I'd say more nurture focused and results focused, more inclusive orientated, that's one that actually means that people are taught to be more accepting and therefore you get less bullying for disabled pupils, and one where teachers, because at the moment teachers just accuse a lot of teachers just accuse any sort of neurodivergent behavior as bad behavior or as misbehavior. I was accused of that many times, and that was why I was always excluded, always had very traumatic experiences. And people just understand that actually often this is emotional stuff or physical stuff or whatever. That's my the way I've seen that solution to be. Unfortunately, again, it's an issue. It's not focused on by many parties. There's just been a send sort of review slash reform being pushed through, but it's very piecemeal and it's very it doesn't actually really address any of the problems that I believe are the real issues.
I think that you have some good points about that, of what could have been in that statement from the Young Liberals, and it's something that hopefully with future conferences or future manifestos in the long term, it's something that could be implemented as I see benefits to having such a specialist education for us, those of additional needs on the same your title place as you'd be able to share resources, and then you could be able to join some mainstream extracurricular stuff, or at least access some of the same resources in terms of gym facilities or whatever, that or that sometimes would need adapting for differently to other classes, but I can see benefits to that. But as I said, a lot of it is to do with again improving that education for those autistic ourselves. As you, it's like I remember before when he was doing an interview, it's somebody said that when they are advocating for better support to those in education, and she said that the in schools there for teachers when you're on getting qualifications, there's nothing in your teaching qualification that you have to train on disability and understand those with additional needs. And as I said, that's something that needs.
The other thing I would say is that in reality, like, it should be part of teacher retraining as well. I would personally say that every 10 years they should probably have that section should be retrained, because as we know, like, our understanding of neurodivergent conditions, of disabilities, of the right way to approach disabilities, of what we know scientifically about disabilities, that changes all the time. So when I was in like sixth form, for example, I found very interesting that there are teachers that have been teaching for pretty much their entire working career and were coming towards the end of their working career. And I had to make sure that they understood what needs I had, because they didn't really know much of it, because probably when they were learning, there's probably nothing. And all they'd have picked up is from what their experience of teaching was. And most autistic kids are actually not particularly articulate about their conditions, or don't really want to be articulate. While I am very articulate, I talk about it a lot, as we've mentioned. And then there were teachers that were younger, especially ones who had actually been in an economics teacher, who had actually been working in the sort of finance sector before. Those ones tend to be a little bit more understanding, and you could explain it stuff to them easier. But I'd say you need that retraining to keep people up to date with this stuff. And more than just EDI, more than just anti-discrimination, but actually how you can actively support a neurodivergent person or a disabled person within a school setting.
Yeah, and it's like that thing that when you're like, hey, if you're like a first aider in any environment, when you get to qualify as a first aider, it's something that you got to renew every so few years. It's understanding for you wanting to be treated out on the same basis. And as I said, that like when I sent you some of the questions and listed down some information on the policy that you approved on, it's it does, as you say, focus on that environment where that's supporting businesses to have more quiet times and spaces and adapting a, what like how the justice system perceives autistic behaviour, and as well as like doctors and medical people understanding autistic people and their communication, their needs. How do you think that the policy of the Liberal look in the next manifesto for the next general election, and how do you think that issues around the neurodivergency and disability will shape in the next general election, or in the at least the next elections and next era of politics?
Again, I mentioned that my special education needs policy, that's unlikely to be in anywhere, because it never made it to federal conference. But I do know that just before me, the Young Liberals had managed to pass a, oh, unfortunately, I actually hadn't had any involvement in, weirdly. It was on specifically on autism accessibility in general society, and that did become federal policy. So we might, that might end up being the manifesto. I don't know. I am not involved in any of the groups that are writing the manifesto. What I do know is, unfortunately, in terms of like disability related stuff, those these sort of issues don't ever often become front and center. They won't be on the headlines when we release that manifesto, but they might be there in small print, and that in a way is a win. So I don't know, but I think the one thing I do feel like about the election is it probably will a bit be a little bit messy in terms of for any minority groups. There will probably be a lot of cultural rhetoric and attack lines on that sort of stuff. But it's, yeah, it's in our constitution though that we fight for disabled rights and LGBT plus rights. And I feel like we are going to have more disability policy in this manifesto than we've had before, and probably more than other parties do, to be honest, as well. I've got some confidence, but I can't really comment because I'm not particularly well acquainted with our policy on that level, at least.
Because at least, like from listening to Ed Stevie's speeches and the conference speeches and stuff for the within the Navy staff, he's been that speaking about in interviews as well and with other members of parties, get a sense that there will be a lot on carers, supporting the carers, and looking at the healthcare system and being policy. And creating a fair dealing manifesto on that. And but also I know with disabled and people and with a lot of people after seeing the Liberal Democrats government record has been lost faith and trust on the basis of the era of austerity when we went into coalition when the Liberal Democrats went into coalition over the 9 years for the Conservative Party. So how do you see that era of austerity yourself, and did you that affect how you think about the party?
That's got a little bit to tag onto what you're saying about Ed. I really think he's amazing in the way he's been standing up for carers. He personally has been a carer pretty much his entire life because he was a young carer for his mum and his grandparents. And then since becoming a parent, he's been a carer for his disabled son. So he actually has a lot of personal experience of that. And I've had the fortune to talk to him about personally about carers and about neurodivergence and disability policy. And he's actually on a personal level really supportive, which has been absolutely brilliant. And that's very personal for me as well, because I was excluded from school so much of my childhood that my mum was my carer. She got carer's allowance. She didn't actually go back into work after I started school because of me, and spent a lot of time looking after me. I'm really happy about that. But in terms of like austerity and the coalition, I've never really viewed the party too negatively because of that. I don't think I personally agree with a lot of the decisions taken under coalition. There's a whole debate about whether the party should have gone to coalition or not, or whatever. I'm not going to try and get into that. And I know that we probably could have been more effective in the things we were fighting for. I knew there were a lot of things that the Lib Dems were able to stop. And there, I do feel like a lot of people who are really, by this point, we are now 9 years on from the end of the coalition. By this point, the people that are still really unhappy about it, generally speaking, the people that are really would probably be opposed to the party anyway. It's like the people that are probably still, there are probably some who are still unhappy with Labour over Iraq. People that would be unhappy with another party, with a certain party anyway, so they'll hold on to it. And I feel like there is trust that still needs repairing. I think a lot of it is being repaired almost by itself, by the way you look at. I find that I used to see Labour as a really good alternative to the Lib Dems. I'll vote Lib Dem at the end of the day, but Labour will probably, if Labour enters government, I'll be happy. But I wouldn't be surprised if by the end of Keir Starmer's first term as Prime Minister that people will actually be really disappointed with Labour's disability policy, because I haven't heard anything they've said about welfare. Welfare tends to be the big one here. I haven't heard them say anything about welfare, but realistically, are they going to reform the PIP benefit system to be more less hostile to disabled people? I'd be surprised. I don't think you can make it more hostile, to be honest. But I think we'll probably end up losing trust in them as well. And that's a bit of a disappointment for me because I know that I'm a member of a different party to Labour, but I'd much rather they have a good set of policies on disability than that. And if they gain from that, so be it. I'm happy with that. because that's a win for me at the end of the day. I'm not, I wouldn't want them to have any bad policies just so that it's electorally advantageous to my party. But in terms of like us in the coalition, it's hard because it's also virtue of association, and the Lib Dems themselves weren't really that crucial in cutting funding in the actual austerity program itself, at least on the details front. Maybe on the big picture front, from the leadership of Nick Clegg and other senior members within the party, maybe that was a major thing. But the thing is that the way that we in the UK are not used to coalition politics, most countries are. Most in Europe, most countries will be governed by some form of coalition, and democracies have some form of coalition politics. But we generally don't, and we will lump all the blame onto a party that was involved, when actually, often in other countries, you have coalitions of three, four, maybe even five different parties, and in there, kind of everyone has to take the blame, and you have to accept that your party will end up doing something that you don't like. In some way, we've been a bit unfair. I get it in a way. I personally don't think that. I don't agree with a lot of things that happened in the coalition. I don't regret the party entering coalitions. I don't think it would have been advantageous coalitioning with Labour, but it's I can see why people really struggle with it.
Is it something that when you've been campaigning, like chatting to people, and if ever people involved in politics, has it been mentioned at all?
Much more at university and in general sort of political settings than on the doorstep. I think most Lib Dems will have a story of at least one person on the doorstep who will have said, I'm never going to vote for you again because of the coalition. But I don't think I've had one from that, but I think I had people that probably was that was the reason. But I find a lot of people will bring it up when you're doing a sort of debate at university, not so only in seminars, not as much in seminars. You don't usually debate that stuff in seminars, but stuff like the Politics Society or any cross-party events we're running, it's brought up a lot. And I'm just I could tell because a lot of the people that are really opposed to it tend to be people that are very involved quite deeply within their own party. And it is a thing that's mentioned still, but it's that's just the way it is. I'm fine with it. I think I got a bit if people mention it too much, I get a bit frustrated because it's like a bit of a broken record.
Talk about like your gender and sexuality, which I know you're open about, and it's like something that very recently you came out in terms of gender and sexuality. Can you share about some of your own story of that?
It's been a very unexpected journey over the past 2 years. I'd say it started around sixth form. I've been at a male-dominated special school. No one there really cared about relationships. So I think that was just a thing people didn't really have time for, didn't really care about. I thought I'd assimilated quite well into that role of boy, but I hadn't really. I now look back on that and I go, I was the least masculine person in a lot of my classes. And that kind of, in a way, contributed a bit to the bullying, just in a way that I didn't notice. So I turn up at sixth form and it is in the middle of COVID, admittedly, and everyone's talking about who their crushes are, who they want to date, who's going out with who, and I'm like, I have no understanding of any of this. What do I do? I don't question my sexuality. I just plow on with my A levels and work hard. And when I'm not working, I'm going out sailing or whatever. And I just think, I'm above this all. I was actually quite self-righteous. I was like, I'm above this all. But we go 18 months on, and I'm doing my exams. And weirdly, as we run up to those exams, and I'd had a couple of things I'd noticed with sort of relationships, not just at school, but in Young Liberals at my first Young Liberals conference. And I think maybe I might be queer in some way. And I just had this sense inside that I was in the LGBTQ community. And I didn't know how. And the term that kept coming back to me was asexual. And I don't know why, but it just did. I didn't even know what it meant at that point. And then I met a friend through the Young Liberals who also used that label. And I was so surprised that he did because he wasn't particularly sex averse. He was actually very, what we describe as sex favourable. And I was like, I don't understand that. And so I go on to Stonewall, I look up what that definition is. And I was like, okay, that's fair. And I work and I start thinking, actually, maybe I might be something. So I originally thought I was what we call demisexual, having only attracted to people that I'm already connected to, and switched out eventually to asexual. And I thought about it for months on end, spent pretty much half a year focusing on it. I was like, I went over it again and again in my head. Had I felt it towards this person or that person? Did I just look of people aesthetically? And I was out, I told people at uni, and then I came to terms with it one night where I came out to myself. And that was right about late 2022. I then, around about the same time, realized I was aromantic as well. I'm at this age, I'm now 19, and I've never had any romantic feelings for anyone. I've probably got a mental list of about 5 or 10 people that I've had a very deep emotional connection to, along to spend time with. I've never really had a will want to date any of them or have any romantic connection or a romantic relationship with them. I sort of feel these are almost like phantom crushes in a way, because I second guess myself a lot. And especially if you go from those five people or narrow it down to two or three, there are people that I do think, do I actually just fancy them? But I don't, because I don't want to date them and I don't want a relationship with them. I just want to be best buddies, really. I just want to be best friends. And then I come home from university for at the end of my first term, and I come out to my parents. It was just a very difficult emotional experience, a very stressful experience. And I thought, okay, that's brilliant. I'm now out as ace, and I can just carry on with my life and just be proud of my identity. But 2 days later, that all gets turned on its head. I just, for some reason, kept started thinking about gender. I don't know why. And I discovered a label that at the time I thought it fitted me, and I realized it didn't, because at that point I thought, part of me feels this sort of agender sense. Part of me feels that I'm outside of gender, but surely I'm just still a man or something. So I might be a demi boy, as we'd call it, so where you're part outside of that gender identity and part male. So I thought spiral about this for weeks, and eventually, after that, question it again and again, and I settled down and I considered myself agender. I thought, I don't have a gender identity, I'm just me. I can keep presenting the way I want, keep my birth name, keep all this stuff, and that'd be the end of it. But we all know what that's like. It wasn't. So I, as just the start of it, I came out again to my parents, to people around me, and I realized that actually I did want a new name, and I did want to, I had a few experiences in gender dysphoria pretty much my entirety of my adolescence, and I'd had gender envy, and in reality that's probably the reason why, because what I'd originally thought of sexual attraction was really just a form of gender envy. So I wanted a bit more like a girl. So we got, yeah, into, we're now talking, we're getting to around about summer 2023, summer last, and I say, okay, I'm not just agender, I'm also trans feminine, and I start slowly transitioning. So I pick a new name, I pick the name Bex, I come out to people with that name, I start adopting new pronouns, which I've set on to be they, she. I then buy more clothes that I'm happy presenting, like crop tops or various things like that. Start growing my hair out. And I'm eventually just doing the things I've always been longing to do for a while. I've wanted to do all these things for a very long time, but for I couldn't because I was a guy. And then this year I sort of started thinking again, because I realized that actually the labels weren't quite fitting. Labels never fit. They can only just describe yourself. They can't fit yourself perfectly, but I need them to fit enough for me to feel comfortable. So I thought, actually, in a lot of ways, I'm like a girl, and that's the thing, I feel that way. I like calling myself a girl. I like thinking about myself in that way. I'm not fully binary trans. I thought about that. Am I trans? I'm not, because I don't fit into that social role. Don't want to fit into that social role. Don't really care about passing, all that stuff. So I call myself a demigirl. I'm girl, part outside of that binary, non-binary. And that's been a really wild journey, if I'm honest. It's not been one I expected ever. I've always seen myself as an ally of the trans community, but I never thought that I'd actually be in the trans community. But it's like I was really in that, in a box, in a way where I never really cared about clothes. I'd always put on whatever I could. Or I never cared about the way I did my hair or anything, because I just wasn't enjoying it, and I was inside this box and tried to fit myself in, tried to pretend being a man, but it didn't work. I'm now outside that box, I can do whatever I want, and really anything I'm doing is trying to experience that gender euphoria, empowering myself, and I don't really regret doing that.
Yeah, and as I said about when you're like, it was with like your gender, it's like that thing of, yeah, I said with the language used around it, it can never really 100% fit. And I think that is very much common, I feel like, not in a binary trans identity of like where you're dead certain that you are actually a female or went trans into male, but because, as you say, that your business is quite gender fluid in a way of. sort of, if you identify as demigirl or de if you ever and previously used, because it might not with gender sometimes if you have that feeling, you might not always fit 100% in that box, or we might not always feel like a permanent thing, but it's just trying to find what feels right for you in the moment.
Yeah, so the way I put it is that, so there's a joke within the trans community and it's called the pipeline, where you start off with she, her pronouns, and eventually you he, him, or you do it the other direction. You start off him, you start off as a cis man, you end up being a trans woman. It's not like that. It's just, but it is a journey. And I remember I think the day after I realized I might be, or might have been the day of, I realized that I might be somewhere in the, I didn't think, I originally didn't use the word trans to describe myself, but I now do. But in the sort of non-cis community, I told a friend, I said, probably my closest friend, the first person I'd ever met who was non-binary and had been for me for everything. And I told them, I might be this. And they're like, cool. And they eventually, I talked to them later on, like months later, and they're like, yeah, I knew you were not gonna end up being what you said you were at that point, because you start there and you move somewhere else. And that's just how it works. And in a way, gender's fluid, not in a gender fluid sense, but gender is fluid in it changes slowly. But for me, it was at first that there'd always been this wanting to not be a boy. I hadn't really put a finger on it. I didn't think it was dysphoria. And I dipped my toe in a little bit and then just started exploring. And I explored a bit. It was very difficult, but I settled it into something that's quite, I'm quite comfortable with now. And a lot of friends just call me a girl. They don't think of me as one, they think of me as non-binary, but call me a girl and treat me like one. And that's all I want, really. Some friends joke that I'm more of a, some cis girls do joke that I'm more of a girl than them because I care a lot about the way I present myself and that sort of thing. And like, for me, it's like I get that euphoria, that comfort from being a girl in presentation and in identity, but I'm not going to fit in that gender binary. I'm a gender rebel. I'm an outlaw, as some would call it. I can't conform to to any norms. I can't in any sense. And for some people, that just means to being gender non-conforming. But for me, actually, I can't even go, I'm going to do that. That's really what it is for me. And what I'd say again is those labels, they don't define you, but they can explain you. They can, like, they can help you understand who you are. And it doesn't matter, for me, it doesn't matter how much of a micro, how few people use that label. If it works for you, it works. I originally used loads of labels, and I think I still do use quite a lot of labels to understand myself. You want more than just going, I'm just me. Some people can do that, some people can be unlabeled, but I need more than that. But I don't, I need to have something that's in the middle.
You do sometimes need more labels because sometimes you almost feel in a way like a sense like a chameleon, because if you like and like how long your life is, you're not going to be the same all the time, and you're not going to feel like stuck in the same place. And I think it's for that, I guess, euphoria is when to feel quite liberated to think that I'm not impressed at if you went, I'm not, you might think that do not you got to be able to feel fine about that. You might not present like all femme like all the time. You might want to wear a mask, spilling more parents by choice. And I think that's the feel I get from being like non-binary, is that you want to have that freedom to change and evolve to how you feel in that moment, and how in that moment how you fit what feels right for you.
Yeah, so the other thing I do, and like I get a lot of joy from supporting other people who are trying to explore their identity, especially gender identity, trying to understand it, and whether that be understanding it from a sort of practical expression present perspective or just from an identity perspective. And the thing I say, it's like a marathon, not a sprint. You can go, okay, I am gonna, and there are different ways of doing it, because often there are things that there are some ways that are very distinctly non-binary, where people are so outside of both binary gender norms that you can only really be non-binary. And there are sometimes you can go feminine, masculine. I go, what you're doing is you are slipping into a role for the rest of your life, not necessarily the same role, but you are trying to be in a role every day. Whether that might be a role that you create yourself, and for me, it pretty much is, because I go, I'm going to be comfy and fairly feminine, but also fairly androgynous, and I decide what I like to wear and what I like to present and how what persona I want to give across to people and all that sort of thing, what pronouns I want. And that's a thing that I go, okay, again, this is very much a thing you want to be in for the long haul. So it's, and I get a lot of freedom from that and going, I can really present how I want. That's what makes it different when people think that trans people are really over the top, or whatever, but most aren't. Like, most of us are just trying to fit into some role. I'm a little bit rare in that not all non-binary people, a lot of non-binary people are very obviously go against gender norms. I prefer to stay within the while I'm seeing myself as outside the binary, I like to my presentation, for example, to stay fairly within it, but in a way that makes me comfortable. And that for me is enough. And that euphoria is an amazing thing, and it can be from the smallest of things. I last week I went out with a friend to go a bit on a one of those sort of Ninja Warrior assault courses, and I went and I wore a crop top and I had my sports bra and like inserts underneath, so I had a non-flat chest, and that gave me a lot of euphoria because I'm just in this public setting presenting in a very non-male way, and for me that was enough to cause gender euphoria. That's It can be the small things like that, and that's what you live for.
What's that like? How's that experience been for like experimenting? And what are the things that for anybody wants to like be able to have that experimentation and then start to go beyond the gender they assigned from at birth? Having a body that is assigned male at birth and having that shape that doesn't necessarily fit the typical feel of women's clothes, as in not you might not have the body that it's designed in terms of shape for that, what has helped you in terms of working out sizes or like what kind of like fits you if it's all together?
Yeah, that sort of stuff is quite difficult. And there's a lot of things that there's a lot of way that having a could just a trusty clothing tape measure can have, and having people that you I find it's helpful just having people both cis and trans that I can talk to who help me with ideas. But find your ways around, and there are some, and you'll find that if you just experiment with what you're doing in any type of clothing, there are some things that will work, some things that won't, some things that will work for you and won't work for others. And in terms of like clothing in general, there's a lot more stuff that is androgynous, and I found like certain things you could find that are androgynous but are not necessarily androgynous in the very androgynous stuff tends to be very masculine, but often you can find stuff that's androgynous but not being masculine. And for me, that's finding stuff that is patterned and colorful and that sort of thing, and often dungarees can be like that, for example, or jumpsuits, and that's often what I'm doing. So you just have to accept that ultimately there are some you're probably on different parts of your body will be wearing very different sizes. Let's say if you for some reason I'm not gonna get NSFW here, but like if you were to wear like female underwear, that's gonna likely to be a very small size. If you were to wear a like female top, that's more likely to be a bigger size. And that you just get used to going, okay, actually, I'm not necessarily this size per se. I am a different size depending on what I'm wearing. And there are some things you do, some like clothing companies will have particular long clothes. So you just try and find what you can. Charity shops are great as well. I'm currently wearing crop tops from I bought a charity shop on campus, which are amazing and comfy. And you can find stuff. And for neurodivergent people, what I'd recommend is you want to find the line between being comfortable in your gender identity and comfortable physically. Because particularly if you're AMAP, female clothing tends to be more restrictive physically. Like I'm quite comfortable being in hoodies all the time, but I'm not so gender comfy. I might be, but I'm not always. But let's say we're in the summer and I cannot go around wearing shorts and t-shirt like I used to, because I didn't like it originally, and now I really don't like it. So I have to find something else. And you have to find the stuff that is something you can feel physically comfy in, but you also know that you feel like you're presenting comfy in. And that is actually a thing you can only do by experimentation. And I would also say just experiment, because what harm can it do, really?
I think that's the thing I think about it, because like when you look at different sizes for rather more fair, more to mass clothes. the different sounds going down, you know, like almost different language to transfer between another. And I think this happening experience is quite different. So for any trans and non-binary person and trying to be a bit more expressed differently with your clothing, then that can be quite a difficult thing to navigate, especially different costs of going through the cost of living crisis now for people. It does make it hard to go through that experimentation.
That's the other thing I would say is that you do have to sometimes do it a little bit baby steps as well. I know that a lot of trans feminine people will often want to go straight to like wearing a dress. I still haven't even bought a dress. I intend on at some point, just because that would be good for me to have something that is formal or semi-formal that I'm comfortable in, because I don't have any formal clothes that I'm comfortable in. But you don't want to go straight to that. What you want to go first is something that for me is it would tend to be something that is like, if you're going feminine presenting, is something that is definitely feminine but not a huge step. Like I went for a camisole top first. That's just like a tank top but more feminine. And yeah, I was wearing that, and at that point I had a really short haircut and a really masculine area away, so everyone was staring at me just walking around campus. But I was okay with that because I was like, I'm taking that risk. So you need to go slowly in some ways and see where you're comfortable first, and you don't and don't, like, again, especially if you're non-binary, it's fine to just drop back into being mask, or if, let's say, you're AFAB, it's fine to drop back into being feminine if you want to. Your identity isn't dictated by your sort of your body and you don't have to. Just because you aren't expressing a particular way doesn't actually mean you're not an identity. I don't really, I'm not super bothered about passing as female because I'm not female, but, and for me, it would be a lot of effort and doing stuff like voice training or changing the way I walk or whatever. It takes a lot, and I haven't got the time or energy to put the hours into something like that.
Your gender identity and expression. Do you think that's linked to being neurodivergent?
I think the thing is that we do know that LGBTQ+ people are much more likely to be autistic than non-LGBTQ+ people, and vice versa. But in a way, it's more like when you're neurodivergent, I'm more likely to want to explore my identity. People around me that might be not neurodivergent might be more willing to, might just think nothing of it and might actually be in the community somewhere and not noticed it. And that's fine. Or people more willing to be out and be themselves. I am much more willing to explore that. And I don't want to just accept what's labeled out before me. So that's why I thought, am I LGBTQ+? Am I in that community in the first place? And I'm also, like, just for me, my transition's effectively a special interest. Effectively, outside of like my degree, obviously, I spend a lot of time thinking about what can I do next? What thing can I do? Or even if I'm not thinking about what I can do next, I'm thinking about that identity and I'm writing stuff down to try and understand it more. Or I'm trying to talk to others about it, or I'm doing something about it. And that's actually becoming, I sometimes worry I think about it too much, but that's for me been like a really positive thing. The two are incredibly, I don't think that there's anything that makes autistic people trans. I just think autistic people and neurodivergent people are more likely to come out and are more likely to just not accept the role that society's given them. So that's really why I think there's that correlation. And for me, the two really you can't separate.
Earlier on in the interview, you indicated that from your childhood experience, you fitted a more typical masculine expression of being autistic. Do you think that expression was linked to being masking your autism and masking your gender identity and expression from your young age?
I would say so. I was very stereotypically autistic boy, so I loved my big special interest. My special interest for much of my childhood was trains, and you get to the point when most people aren't watching Thomas the Tank Engine, but you're still going to all the heritage railways and the railway and the sort of railway museums and everything, and you're trying to read everything you can about railways, and I was watching railway documentaries made for people that are probably much older than me or everything. So that was a big special for a while. There's the fact that I academically, it was always thought that my good subject was maths because my mental arithmetic was amazing. It was only later on that I discovered that it was not, and that's very stereotypically autistic male. And so there's a lot of ways it's masked behind the stereotypes that I was fitting into. And it was masked in that sort of way, really, despite the fact that you can look back on it now and go, oh, there were obvious signs in the way I was thinking and the way I was feeling envious towards people of different genders and the way that I wanted to present myself or the body that I wanted or whatever, and the way I felt unhappy with my body. It was masked by the autism in a lot of ways. The other thing I was going to comment on as well is my aromanticism, which is a really interesting one because part of my aromanticism is just the fact I don't understand romance. Like, I understand I want to be friends with people. I love being friends with people. It's not, I'm not the type of autistic and like, I'll shut myself away in my room for days on end. I love chatting with people, even if it's just chatting online. And often my close friends, I just want to become closer and closer with. But I don't understand why people want a relationship with anyone else. I don't get it. And I don't get exclusivity. I don't get the feelings. I don't get all that stuff. That is really linked to the autism. And like, for me, when someone is, let's say, like, going through any particular time in their relationship, there, if they've just started dating, or if they are moving in together, or if it's the end of their relationship, they're breaking up. I really struggle supporting them in that because I'm like, I wish you could spend more time with me and let just hang out and I know watch Disney movies together or like just chat or do whatever. And instead, people are like wanting to do stuff, and I don't hold it against them or anything. It's just I struggle to understand it, and so that's really linked as well. But that was. Masked, it was masked in a way of not being masked because autistic people are generally seen to never be in relationships. Autistic people are never seen to never want to have sex with people or to date people or anything. When I came out as ARO-ACE, it was not really news. It's so what? And the thing is that that's, if I'm honest, it's far from the case. And it like a lot of autistic people are pretty much similar identities to everyone else, but that in a way was almost masked in plain sight, and that's one that it still confuses me in a way.
Something I've related with that, like when we, like you said earlier, that you are quite open, you don't really bottle anything up. Which, if you have a, like a stereotypical male person, is that stereotype of being closed in with your feelings and not openly expressing your emotions. Do you think that having you not been a, like a typical male person growing up, back, you're different in your gender? Do you think that's linked to you being a bit more able to be articulate with your feelings?
Yeah, I will preface this by saying that, like, my general belief is that everyone should be a little bit more open, especially men. Men should be more open about their sort of feelings, their struggles, their mental health issues. Men should not feel like they can't cry and all that sort of stuff. But I was very much non-conforming in that sense for a very long time because I was open about feelings with people, and I was open about my difficulties, and I cried, and I'd cry in public if I did. I never tried to like bottle that stuff up, and I never saw that as really a reason for why I'm not, it's this man. But in a way, it helped me understand that actually, at the very least, I wasn't conforming to these gender expectations. I didn't want to, but that helped in a way that being so open and being so myself really did help me understand that. So that I would say that did help. That I think people struggle with how sometimes some people can struggle with just how open I am, but. I also find that if you're more open, then people around you become more open and just helps in most environments as well. So I've been saying about 6 years now, and that also started my special school. We went out on a old tall ship style yacht with a charity called the Island Trust, who help disadvantaged groups on sailing voyages, and I loved it. And I spent loads of time on the wheel steering the ship and a lot of time just doing whatever I could to help. I love the feeling of the wind. I love the sort of the waves and just the sense of achievement in it. So I got home, and a few weeks later, I went to a sailability, and sailabilities are groups that support disabled people getting sailing. And that was what I needed for me at the moment because I needed more one-to-one support in a boat. I needed people around me who understood me, all that stuff. And I just flourished from then on because I got much more independent. I got a load more communication skills. That was all recognized in 2020 when I got awarded the Sailability Sailor of the Year for those achievements. And I started sailing more normal capsizable dinghies because those originally were in non-capsizable dinghies. Now I sail all sorts. And I do keelboat sailing off in Cowes on the Isle of Wight with the Andrew Castle Foundation, who support me from a more coaching perspective and effectively providing coaching that's more me as a disabled person, that just generally supports disabled people, but as a someone who needs a less intense environment but still wants to race, and I've never wanted to stop racing. I always want to win. And yeah, I try to enter at least two or three events, two or three regattas a year, and spend the time in between training. I do stuff with the university sailing team. I'm a sailing instructor for my club as well. So there's a lot of things I do, and it's just become the biggest special interest I could have ever had, really. It's absolutely huge. It often feels like my entire life is being based around it in some sense.
Do you want to talk about your Instagram? Please also say what you wish people to take away from this interview.
This all came about fairly naturally. As I think a lot of us found about last year, active Twitter users just became very frustrated. I was finding it completely unusable. I never really drifted onto any of the other platforms, and I ended up just spending more time on Instagram, which I'd already been on for a while. I was getting more and more into sailing as well at that point, so I was following a lot of my sailing friends. And it's a really different focus for me because on Twitter, I've been mainly focusing on politics. I've been chatting with people in the party, in other parties. And like on Instagram, I was more about stuff about myself and sailing. And so I started posting more, and I'd go to events, and after when I come back from the event, I'd effectively write up almost like a blog post style post on Instagram about what happened, what I got up to, what I learned from it. Took a lot of inspiration from a few very good friends in the sailing community, or as well just people I look up to in the sailing community, who do an absolutely fantastic job of documenting. I was inspired like a lot by one or two friends within the sailing community who do an absolutely fantastic job at documenting both their sailing journey, but also a little bit about personal experiences. Generally, as disabled people, there's not usually much queer representation within sailing. And I wanted to do the same, to be honest, mainly from a neurodivergent angle. I wanted a personal journey. I created it, and I wanted to talk about a journey as an autistic and trans sailor. I didn't want to just use this as an excuse to talk about sailing. I will go weeks or months where I'm actually not doing events. It's actually been quite a while since I last did my last event. I'm still training. Sometimes I do talk about what I'm getting up to, especially if I'm going all the way to Cowes for a weekend or if I'm doing anything particularly notable. But often there isn't much to talk about, but I'll fill that time by talking about neurodiversity and trying to get people to understand that and accept that more. So I've talked about the routine that's necessary for me. Let's say if I'm going to an event, I will have to listen to particular songs when I'm on either in the car or on the train to an event, or I will talk about that. If it like the other day was trans and I talked about gender euphoria and the sort of impact of that, and that was mentioned sailing but wasn't focused wholly on sailing. And really that count just serves two. The first is being representation for two communities that need more visible representation within the sailing world. So that's neurodivergence and in particular transgender and non-binary people, because there is some LGBT plus representation in sailing, but there's not really that much in terms of trans people. So that's about educating people on inclusivity and creating more inclusive environment. I'm hoping that I'm giving more confidence to trans and neurodivergent people and showing them that you can achieve your goals. And that might be in sailing. That might not be in sailing. That might be anywhere else. I'd love to grow it and get more followers. I've got about 60 or 70 at the moment, and I'd love to be getting into triple digits because by that point I can really start to get a message out to a wide group of people. I'm not bothered about the fame or popularity or anything. I'm not going to monetize it or anything. I just want to get this message out to people and just effectively change those perceptions, challenge those perceptions within society and have an activist impact through that way. I think there's a couple of things I've got to say. So, like, one thing I think in terms of what I want for like neurodivergence, and that's just acceptance and those societal perceptions need to be challenged. And as I was mentioning with the sailing Instagram, that's about challenging perceptions and going, yeah, I can do this. And neurodivergent people can do that. But we just need to do it more widely and to show that actually we can do stuff. I was told I could not go to university unless it was like an hour away or maybe even studying at. I am now a southerner who's at university in the north. I have been told that I couldn't travel places by myself, but I will travel a long place by myself. I've been told I couldn't do this type of sailing, like the type of sailing you do at university, but I've done it. All this stuff, people think we can't really look after ourselves, or we can't go into politics, or we can't get a particular career. And in reality, we can, and we have a lot of strengths that other people don't have. And we need to show those strengths and really celebrate that. And it's a huge thing I'd love to have an impact on. And then the other message I really want to put out is that life just goes in interesting directions. And when we're talking about LGBT plus identity, I only really realized that I might have been somewhere in the community about 2 years ago. And I never thought that I'd be talking to you here as a trans girl. I'm added to that, I'm actually a practicing Christian and I go to church fairly regularly. And you'd think that I'd lose my faith, but I didn't. My faith in the church pretty much went down, but my faith is really connected with my queerness. So you need to be ready for surprise in life. Joy in life can be really empowering and it makes all the struggles we have really worth it. So I have some form of PTSD probably from early experiences of primary school and mistreatment there. And that's because of being autistic and neurodivergent. And it took only until about a few years back that I actually accepted my neurodivergency as something that I actually really liked part of me that I didn't want to get rid of. And as a trans person, I have to deal with discrimination. I have to deal with dysphoria and an uninclusive society, a cultural debate. And then as an erased person, I'm seen as lonely and broken. But would I change my neurodivergence or my identity as demigirl or my transness or my asexuality or my aromanticism for absolutely anything? No, I'd never change that in a million years. And there are tough times, but I found ways to love every aspect of my identity. And that joy and empowerment I feel from that, actually, I don't regret in being in this position in any way. If I could trade the world for my identity, I just wouldn't. So I would say just find that joy, whatever that joy is, and harness it as much as you can and take pride in being yourself. And you can get a long way in life for doing that.
You said your faith, your queerness is linked to your faith.
I really see like the queerness in a way as a gift from God. And there are verses, they're actually probably more affirming verses in the Bible than what people try to quote as transphobic verses. And there'll be stuff such as about how effectively eunuchs, who were non-binary people of the day, were blessed as part of the kingdom of heaven, who are blessed as important members of community and society. And in a way, for me, I almost see it as I'm outside of that gender binary, which is really part of the world that is not godly. And by accepting that I can't be part of that, I can live a life that is more for God. And I think those two are just so connected. And I just feel that in a way, I'm making the world and creation and God's creation a really beautiful place by being myself and not being what society wants me to be. And there's a lot in the Bible about not being a conformer, not saying what society, doing what society says we should. And that I think is really beautiful.
Thanks again for Bex for coming on the podcast. And do remember, if you want to email the podcast, it's newerainbowcast, no, newerainbow at newerainbowproject.com. And again, as said with Bex, if you want to follow them on social media, you can find them by searching for the handle on Instagram, SailingBex, at SailingBex, they are. And so that's how you can find them on social media, where they post most of their stuff on Instagram. But as I said again, if you want to get in touch with coming on the podcast, please do, because as I said, you want to have some more diverse and balanced discussions about varying different things. So, as I said, you can get myself via the email or going into the DM. Message me in my DMs at New Rainbow Project on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok as well. So if you want to, that's if you want to get in touch. But as I said, it was great to have Bex on, and I'll have another episode this week, and I hope, and I'll be recording that later today that this is going out to Kayla Smith. We'll be chatting to her about a whole host of different things about being autistic, and so that'll be great. So, please, as I said, please do get in touch, please do share this as well. And if you also want to find out more about the podcast, go on the website, newerainbowproject.com. That's where you'll be finding the readable articles of this, and also I'll be coming soon, I'll be bringing some articles as well to, for you to be able to listen to on the podcast. So some of the written stuff that I have done on the website, you'll be able to listen to them as an audio podcast. So if you want to, so if you, that, you know, you might not want to concentrate on reading something online, so you'll be able to hear, you know, it being read to you, and that'll be one way of getting our content from this podcast. And thanks again for listening to the podcast, and see you again, see you next week.